I would trade him if I could.
I don't think many people liked it, to be honest. I don't care.
Last year didn't really do well for anybody.
We should probably delete all of this.
By the laws of the podcast gods, we owe an answer.
Reporting the Highline with Rabbi in Red. Talking the rapids and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car or in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the Highline.
Hello, Murder Hornet fearing Rapids fans. You are listening to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red, brought to you by Icarus FC and Roughneck Scarves. It is Thursday, May 7th, 2020, day number 56 of MLS's suspension of play. And since Monday was Star Wars Day, I guess today is the Seventh Awakens. This weekend is potentially the final without soccer as the K-League and the Bundesliga prepare for a May 15th kickoff or re-kickoff in the case of Germany. There is a destination in sight with MLS teams making pitches and facilities available. I spoke with Robin Fraser on a media conference call earlier today, and he said the Colorado Rapids will be ready for individual training on two pitches this coming Monday. That's eight Rapids players who could potentially be training individually at the exact same time. I am joined now by the Adrian McGeady to my George Honeyman, the alpha among alphas on the soccer-loving Rabbi Dream Team, Rabbi Mark Goodman.
I'm really more the Josh Magia because, you know, I left. That's the thing. I left and went to, spoiler alert, that's only episode two, though. So you're not, or episode three, I think, that you find that out. But, like, you know, we're talking about Sunderland Till I Die episode two. Which was is great. I'm in the middle of it. Spoilers. You know, no spoilers. I'm pretty sure things don't work out for Sunderland though, because it's Sunderland and they're Sunderland. But yeah, I think we probably talked about it like last year when we watched season one. Why am I having a problem confusing episodes and seasons? It's because you started off with Star Wars. I think that we love it specifically because the suffering and the misery tracks neatly with the experience of being a Colorado Rapids commentator / fan. There are some aspects that I like. I think it's really funny. One of the weird trade-offs in American sport versus England is in England, the stadium is usually beautiful, and the quote-unquote gantry, the place where media sits, is horrendous. And in America, the stadiums are kind of mediocre, but usually the media digs are pretty decent. And we have a similar situation, although up in DSGP, there almost is a proper gantry because there's this tiny little ledgy thingy that you have to sit out on these really uncomfortable chairs in order to watch the games. And it reminds me of a proper British gantry on some level.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that front, Mark. I guess I can speak to, in my previous, European exploits, I was doing the tour at Chelsea, for example. I think I've told this story before. It was, about a year and like 2 weeks ago or so. And so I was going on the tour. There was no reservation. You just like show up or whatever. And so, they had these little monitors and everything, and you could do different languages, obviously, because Chelsea's a big international club. And so we found out about 10 minutes in, the guy did, that I was the only native English speaker. So he'd be doing the spiel, and then basically instead they would just have the headsets, and then so you'd press on your little not tablet but like smartphone-y like device thing, and then basically it would just play the audio equivalent with the text in French or German or, you know, whatever language it was. So basically you just turned it into, I'll do the spiel and then we can end up bantering about it. And then so, of course, as soon as we get to the main home side and everything, I'm asking, well, where's the press box? Where do the press sit and everything? We go to the back room where they would do the media interviews, for example, where obviously Jose Mourinho had berated many a London sports writers. And so I was just amazed at how fancy the backspace was and everything, Mark. And they said on an average Premier League game for a night game or for a weekend game, They said at Stamford Bridge, Chelsea gets about 100 media people. And then for Champions League or like a bigger or like an FA Cup semifinal or everything, they can get to about 150. Once they get to anything close to 200, they start to have to move people around or add extra seats or make some extra space. And they had a couple of years ago at the time, they had a, I think it was a round of 16 or it might have been the second knockout round of the Champions League against Barcelona, in which they had in excess of 200 professional media requests, obviously with a significant number of Spanish language people coming over from Spain. And that was the first and only appearance that Lionel Messi has made at Stamford Bridge. And I think his only appearance that he's actually made at any stadium within London proper, interestingly, well, with Barcelona, I should say. Not sure about. I'm sure he's played at some point for Argentina at Wembley, for example. So in any case, where was I going with this, Mark? So to your point, I guess the thing that I would say is I would agree with you. The media setup is probably highly variable, but certainly I'd say the newer Premier League stadiums are certainly much nicer from a media dig standpoint. I guess the other thing that I'd add is normally the media gets really, really good seats, like the prime seats that you would normally have, you know, like the anywhere from the second O to the D in Colorado and either side is where the media would get. Like, you get the prime, like, seats that you would normally have for, like, the $150 minimum at DSG Park, for example, and then you've got everything spread out. You've got a monitor to where you can rewind the game and everything, you know, a bunch of outlets and everything, and then obviously the older stadiums have hardwired in an Ethernet connection as well, whereas I'd say in most stadiums, soccer-related or otherwise, you know, you're up all the way as far back as, you know, as you can be. You know, it's the back last couple of rows on one side at Pepsi Center, you know, that has the outdoor as the, like, not behind the glass media area for some print press. And then obviously everybody who's doing TV and radio are behind the sort of the glass screens that they have. Mile High is probably one of the few exceptions because you have that press area that's just below, it's right at the 200 levels or so, but a lot of times you're up in the 300, so, which is fine for me because I'm used to cheap seats from a spectator standpoint, but also used to just being far away for that, whereas it's kind of in the opposite. So, you know, if we were to take, you know, if we were to take St. James's Park for Newcastle, for example, because I was looking at photos, for example, with all the hoopla about Mike Ashley selling them to the Saudi king and whatever. And so you basically look where they have the media set up. If that stadium were plopped into the NFL right now, they'd tear that up. And, you know, those would be thousands of dollars season tickets. And if the Super Bowl was there, those would be the absolute best seats that you could possibly get. So how did we get here from Sunderland Till I Die, Mark?
You were talking about stadiums that you'd toured, man. That was it.
Yeah, but you had talked about the Stadium Light is a very, very nice stadium, I would say.
Yeah, it's good. Stadium tours are good. I'm not a big fan of the idea of a stadium tour. Like, if I'm going to go to a stadium, I want there to be a match played. But
I'm a big fan of it because I have to ask a bunch of architectural questions and engineering questions because I'm a nerd.
Yes. It seems like every time I've been to England, though, the last couple times I've been to England were in the summer. So it's really unfortunate. But, you know, like this, once we get out of quarantine, I think some people lost a lot of money. Some people are holding neutral and their economics are difficult. But there's probably a significant number of people who are like, I had a vacation planned. It didn't happen. I now have money that I need, that I want to spend. And what, you know, it's like a good time to say to yourself, like, I'm going to take that dream vacation to England and finally see Craven Cottage. You know, like, that's my pitch for, I'm trying to single-handedly revitalize the economy, Matt.
So Mark, I'm going to point of order and actually get us back on track here. So Sunderland Till I Die, season two. I thought it was more, at least so far, having seen the whole thing and knowing how things turn out, I thought it was more interesting than season one. I thought it was nice to see somebody on the business side and then somebody, you know, we got perspectives both from the players and what was going on the field, and then also from the business side, what they were doing from with the club, where obviously in season one, they had the owner in Florida, I can't remember his name, who was, you know, very distant both physically and in terms of interest. So we didn't really have that. So we only got the technical side of things. But in terms of looking in and seeing the, how do you run a football club? What are the money significance and just the massive impacts that you have from a revenue standpoint when you're dealing with a relegation battle or a promotion battle? I guess the thing that we could compare that to, Mark, is say, you know, the last year of FC Cincinnati and planning if they have for the next couple of years, understanding whether or not they're getting MLS expansion or not and what that means from them. And I guess the other thing, and I would couple this in with Take Us Home, the Leeds United promotion bid docuseries that Amazon Prime put in. I love the episodes of the ones where we focus in on that final transfer window and everybody's in the war room and looking at scouting reports and making all the phone calls and, you know, things aren't or are working, for example. I would love to, the Rapids would never agree to this. I don't think any team in MLS would agree to this, but of just, I want to sit in the room on transfer deadline day, that secondary transfer deadline day, because, you know, the primary one just extends out so far that it's not as interesting. Or I guess if the super draft ever gets more interesting, or like on the day of like the re-entry in the expansion draft, I'd love to just sit in the war room. I'm not going to report on anything. I just want to have the right to listen for the sake of context of what the heck is that like in an MLS room? Because you saw it was an absolute madhouse, Mark. And I think who was it? Not Charlie, the other one who's sitting on the couch, you know, at the end of, you've seen the end of the January transfer one where they buy Will Grigg, yes? So yeah. Where he's just like, where he gets off the phone and they've done the deal and everything, he's just like, this football club is gonna kill me. That resonated with me so much. And I think there's so much of that that is behind a curtain for so many soccer teams. And that's what a lot of outlets, not particularly the ones that we've ever written, been contributors to, Mark, you know, make their money on just like, oh, some random tweet or, you know, somebody said, or, you know, this thing, like they run wild with that in England. And every single technical person I've ever spoken to on record or candid says that about 50% of that is made up and about 25% of that is just based on incomplete information without context, and they're just running with it. So in terms of my own writing and understanding, when those rumors come up or when somebody gets rumored or when I joke to Porrig Smith, you know, hey, when we talk about DPs, I say Cristiano Ronaldo to the Rapids, and he jokingly says, yeah, Matt, which, you know, technically if I'm just reading the transcript, that's Colorado Rapids confirm interest in Cristiano Ronaldo. That is something that I think there is an incomplete understanding of from a media and a fan standpoint. I would like more of that in order to better understand that and better cover those moments.
So I'll say that I agree. It's interesting that you said like that the Rapids would never let a reporter do that. One is, I think they would. I think Grant Wall can have access to whatever he wants. And I think that the reason, and it's an interesting meditation, which is to ask the question, like, what gives a certain sports writer the street cred to be able to waltz in? And the answer is just, you know, readership and promotion and the ability to kind of elevate a story, which we don't have just because we don't have the right outlets behind us. But the other thing I was going to say was that the Rapids kind of did do their own in-house documentary. And of course, that's going to be sanitized, but I don't think the original intent was for it to be sanitized when they came up with it. I forget the name of it, but they did their own in-house documentary last year. And I think maybe it even went back the year before that. But because they wound up basically covering the worst moments of the Anthony Hudson era, they wound up basically, like, they didn't shoot it. They didn't wind up doing as much of it. They also lost a number of people on their comms side, and I think that that kind of slowed down the project also. But yeah, you know, I think if you don't, I think the idea of a real NFL Hard Knocks inside, no holds barred, absolute honesty type series is difficult for MLS teams because the guts of it are pretty gnarly. I mean, it's a more rough and tumble show. I think the Rapids financials and the candid conversations that they either have to have or that they hide from us are pretty tawdry to some degree, in the sense that, like, a lot of the things that you and I either complain about off mic or allude to on mic or sometimes hit straight up or the things that fans talk about at the bar, you know, the really rough and tumble stuff of Stan Kroenke cares more about X than Y. I think you would get a front row seat to that if HBO were making a documentary about the Rapids.
Yeah, well, I guess the thing that I'm asking for, Mark, I'm going to assume you have not seen the movie Draft Day.
I don't even know what that is.
Okay, it's a fake movie. Who is the Kevin Costner is the lead in it, and in the movie he is the general manager of the Cleveland Browns on draft day. And so they're trying to rebuild the team. They've got the new head coach, again, all fictional. There's nobody who appears is an actual person. So this isn't like Jerry Jones or, you know, anybody from the Pittsburgh Steelers. It's the real NFL teams, but none of the actual executives or anything. And so he's in there on draft day and they're thinking about whether or not they want to move up and make a trade for the number one pick. What do they do with the number one pick? I won't spoil how it goes out. It has a really funny quote at the end, about pancakes, but so they end up getting the team that they want. I don't know how realistic that was in terms of negotiating, you know, like, we want your first round pick, but we'll swap first round picks, but then yours is more value, so we'll give you a second and then, like, another guy. What does this mean for us from a cap standpoint? They go through all of that in pretty good detail, how realistic that is to, you know, say an average NFL draft in terms of, like, you know, one of the general managers, you know, being a producer on the show, being like, that's not actually how it would happen, or this is how you would do it. That's the kind of stuff that I want. So I don't so much want a Hard Knocks. I want a documentary draft. I want draft day for soccer in a documentary form. Like, if they were to just do, like, let's just have somebody in the war room, let's have a camera in the war room of every single one of the major, like, top 10 Champions League teams from a money standpoint during the final day of the transfer window, that's something that I'd want. Or if they, you know, if you could in hindsight get film of, like, the inevitable deal of Neymar getting sold from PSG, for example, or Cristiano Ronaldo leaving Juventus, for example. Like, that's something that I would want. And I thought Sunderland Till I Die, both in season one and in season two, both in the August of assembling the team with everything that they had going on, and in the big controversial and climactic moments that they had in the two January transfer windows, were very good, had very good insight, were fantastically directed. And as you will see, Mark, as you already know what happens in how the season ends for Sunderland, like, it is squeaky bum time for the full final two episodes. The second to last episode was spectacularly directed. I've had a couple soccer friends and a couple friends who were actually in film school say they would not have changed anything from the screenshots to how they did it to the voiceovers and everything. The fans they were following just perfectly encapsulated those moments emotionally. And I think the thing where I really got drawn into it, Mark, in addition to the suffering that you have of the, oh, I know what this pain feels like, I know what having hope feels like, and then having it completely crushed and feeling down in the doldrums and everything, was just the fan perspective and everything, and how you kind of follow them throughout the year and how they experience. I feel like I'm living vicariously through those Sunderland fans. And I think regardless of whether or not you are a Sunderland fan, just being a sports fan, being a soccer supporter, they do a fantastic job of encapsulating those experiences that we all know what that feels like. Okay, the Rapids have never been relegated, for example, but the Rapids have lost finals. The Rapids have had terrible seasons. The Rapids have had, you know, moments and glimmers of hope and have it crushed at the end. We could say, you know, Decision Day last year was like that. And so in that, I think they did a fantastic job illustrating the emotions behind it, and in that it is something universal that you can watch and enjoy and completely understand what those supporters are going through moment to moment from start to end.
It's great. Well said. I highly recommend it. I think it's really enjoyable. I definitely, I don't entirely agree with you in you're saying like season two is much better. I actually like season one a lot. I do feel like they spend a little bit too much time kind of with the manager and the general manager and the owner. There's some smart inside kind of businessy windowy thingies in the first episode, the second episode, but like I remember first season being a little bit more about fans and how gutted they were and just the backstory of falling from premiership to championship to League One, the financial problems, kind of the chaos of ownership. I thought it was a compelling story, but that doesn't mean that I thought season two wasn't as good because I'm only halfway through. It's really enjoyable, highly recommended. Go see it. By the way, in comparison, I also watched some of English Game, and I thought that was kind of dull. So it wasn't really for me. I'll probably go back to it if we are still in lockdown for much longer, or the MLS doesn't come back anytime soon. But you know, watch all the soccer you can, even if it's got to be scripted television or documentary.
Speaking of soccer, that's actually going to happen, Mark. MLS has laid out their initial plans for the resuming of individual activities on team training grounds and facilities, etc., and then an initial plan forward for how they can actually get to having squad activities and then even a full normal, in air quotes, training session in time for the anticipated June 8th resumption of league play. The league did a very good job of coming out with parameters of what that would look like and the requirements and the protocols that they would have almost from a PPE and a sanitation and quality control standpoint. Mark, I actually had to update my 40-hour Hazwhopper training this week, so that was a very good refresher in that regard from a sanitation and wearing gloves and things like that. Four teams as of recording were able to do that today and even yesterday. Sporting Kansas City, Atlanta United, and there were two others I can't remember, but the Rapids will be ready to go come Monday. I spoke with Robin Frazier about that. They have everything what they need. It's just about getting it organized from, you know, having cones on the field, dummies, anything else that the players would need, and then the capacity to sanitize all of that and make it useful to the point where it's not just, you know, like Jonathan Lewis can walk, you know, two or three blocks to just a grass area in a park where he lives and just kick a ball back and forth with somebody who's, you know, 30, 40 yards away, or he can just, you know, do some running and then, you know, do some drills on his own with a ball with nobody else. But it's getting set up to the point where they have enough equipment and, you know, a quarter of a pitch earmarked per player to where it's actually useful for them to come to the field, go through everything from a quality control standpoint, get on the field and actually do their stuff, and then leave, and then have the club be able to sanitize all of that properly and then make it available for the next player that wants to come up. So they're setting that stuff up. They should be ready to go for Monday, and they'll have two pitches available, presumably, Mark. That will be field 20 and then the field just south of it, or the stadium field. I'm not entirely sure with the parking situation and whether or not players want or need access to the locker room.
But it's basically going to be like eight players on a pitch with coaches around them playing in a box, bouncing balls off of things and having balls bounce to them and playing fairly long passes to each other, right? I mean, like a thing that that I talked about in the interview that is going to debut later is, you know, as a joke, is the concept that like MLS players may be getting really good at long ball because they're going to be practicing long passes because social distancing means they're not going to be able to play in short, tight, close spaces or practice any of that, right?
Yes. One clarification, Mark, it's four players per pitch. So basically everybody gets a quadrant. So two pitches, they'll have eight pitches available, and then there'll be some sideline space. They'll be limited in terms of how they'll be able to walk. There's a very carefully crafted procedure in terms of like you have the four players on the field, the four players want to leave. How do they exit the field, get sanitized, and then get back into their car, for example? And so there's one of those sidelines that won't be available for the players to be walking on, that presumably is where the coaches will be in addition to the players if they want to do any form of instruction. But yeah, you're right, Mark. It's a lot of long balls. The players are going to be holding X on the Xbox controller for an extended period of time, or I guess maybe they're doing long shots. No real clarification on whether or not, I guess, you know, could you, as opposed to separating the field into quadrants? Could you have a player like at the edge of the attacking third trying to put crosses into, like, you know, could Kellen Acosta be roughly in the attacking edge of midfield, and could he be playing a long ball into Kai Kamara, who is in the box, and then I guess just have a dummy for the goalie to try and head the ball in? The league's put out a path to, you know, do a plus sign in the box, not necessarily dividing the field, you know, lengthwise into rectangles, like that. I'm doing a poor job of, you get what I'm saying, Mark, or am I doing a poor job illustrating? Yeah.
No, you're not. You're doing good. I get it. Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting. I mean, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, my assumption is that players have kept up fitness and they've done a lot of limbering up, a lot of yoga, because it can be done in your apartment. And they've done the basic running, but you know, it's weird that we started the season and now we're kind of starting the season all over again, hypothetically. We're also, as you kind of mentioned before, we're going to be watching to see how the Bundesliga and how South Korea handle it. South Korea, you know, they have so few cases that I think, and they look like they're going to have very few problems starting up their league and playing closed door. Whereas the Bundesliga, I think it's a big open question there. I have already heard a story on NPR and read an article in the New York Times that basically were pretty critical of the decision and basically said, you know, they were basically making the argument like nobody's really entirely sure this is the right decision for Germany. And whether fans can really responsibly stay away from the stadium when the players go in, and whether players won't wind up, you know, if one player gets sick from somebody in their life, you know, soccer is a game where you get really close to people, and whether they'll be, you know, in close proximity and capable of, you know, spreading a virus to another player. I mean, we had this problem in the NBA already, and that's what kicked off this whole thing to begin with, as we talked about a couple weeks ago.
Well, Mark, there's already been, I think, Cologne and then a second division team in Germany, the second division set to restart as well, next weekend, who've already had staff test positive. I think, it's been a couple days since I've checked in on this, so I'm not sure if there was any clarification. They said, technical staff. I don't know if that means somebody in the front office. I don't know if that means somebody in the coaching staff or the players, but you know, it's, you know, you make a good point, Mark. So I think if I'm remembering correctly, they're setting themselves up to have sinks on the sideline for players to potentially wash their hands. Everything has to be sanitized. They are forbidding, the pregame handshakes that you'd obviously have. There's going to be no mascots, so none of the kids on the field. But I mean, you know, if you score a goal, like, you can't hug any of your teammates. You're basically just like individually, like, running to a corner and fist pumping. But do you even have that reaction given there's no fans in the state? Like, where are you just from an adrenaline standpoint? Because I think, there was a study that I read a couple, when pitchers are doing their warm-ups, for example, in like an empty stadium in a bullpen, Mark, or on an off day or on a simulated game, for example, like their fastball, just when it's in an actual game setting with fans in the ballpark, goes up like somewhere between like 3 and 6 miles per hour. So, you know, do you even have the adrenaline, that reaction as a player? You can't hug any of your teammates. And to your point, Mark, like, if you're a defensive player, you know, somewhere in the back of your head, if it's my grandmother lives with me, for example, do I want to tackle this guy, run into like us potentially making contact, me being exposed to his sweat or body fluid in some way to where I potentially contract coronavirus? Like, there is real, it's not so much I need to make this tackle so that we don't lose the game. There's so many other macro things that are affecting this that I'm not even sure is what we're going to see when Schalke plays Dortmund and Dortmund's trying to challenge Bayern Munich next weekend. Is that going to be anything close to what we would have seen if it was a full stadium in a proper environment and Weston McKennie's just going out there getting ready to wreck fools?
If you were the kind of researcher who has asked the question in the past, what is the home field advantage consist of? Like, why do home field advantages occur? This is the year to test the theory perfectly, because if your theory is it's the unfamiliarity of the stadium, or it's the bounce of the field, or it's the pitch, versus it's the pure adrenaline that's provided by your home crowd rooting for you, you can actually look at that. You know, you'll be able to look at how Dortmund plays this year or how Bayern plays this year at home versus how they played last year at home, knowing that it's just going to be absolutely silent in there. And without their fans, like, it, there's some of the advantage is going to be lost almost certainly.
Yes, the rest of this year for the European season and potentially, you know, an extended period, possibly the entire MLS season, Mark, this is our control group for does the Timbers Army have that significant of an impact? Does the wall at Dortmund Stadium have a significant impact? Does the fact that, you know, teams that play in smaller venues, for example, you know, what's there? Does the fact that Red Bull Arena has an echoey environment because there's not that many fans there, is that really significant? And so in that regard, Mark, as I asked Robin about this, you know, how much are you worried about? Because so I was asking him about the time scale for getting 90 minutes fit at altitude, because the club obviously spent the majority of their preseason in California. Then, you know, they were in California leading up to, they left from Southern California to DC from the home opener. So really in terms of actual pitch activity, they just had that 1 week prior to the home opener against Orlando at altitude. Now, obviously they've been, you know, back in Denver, you know, since then. So what, March, like 8th or 9th probably, that entire time. They haven't been doing team activities. He's pretty confident that they're okay from a strength and physical fitness and cardiovascular standpoint for the players. But if we're assuming that players are going to have pitches and bikes and everything available to them on Monday, and, you know, Monday is what, I think the 9th, if I'm not mistaken, maybe the 10th, you know, then you're looking at roughly a month leading up to the week of June 8th, assuming there's at least 2 weeks of team activities where you can do some form of scrimmages. He's confident by the second, certainly by the end of that third game back, assuming we progress with that schedule, that they will be 90 minutes fit at altitude in a way that is a statistically significant, measurable. The other team comes in and they're dead at the 75th minute. We can run roughshod over them and be set up and be okay from that standpoint. But, you know, I think this is a fantastic way for us to test that, because we have that data point. Cause, you know, no sports team is going to commit to this study of we're not going to have fans so that you can have a control group of how well does our team play at home when there's no fans.
Yep.
Shall we move on to our last big banter topic, and then you can tease our interview, Mark?
I would be greatly honored, my friend.
Okay, Mark, we got another email from Eric Hoffman, talking the aftermath of us doing, our HTHL all-time best 11 Rapids teams draft, and talking about which jersey we would have our Rapids team, playing at. So first of all, Eric wanted to let you know, Mark, that he has officially completed the move to Pittsburgh over the course of the last couple of days, and he listened to the episodes that we had. He's listened to his first HTHL episode as a resident of Pittsburgh, so I'm sure our Blueberry statistics will see an uptick from our downloads in the great state of Pennsylvania. So he'd like to preemptively thank us for keeping him connected through our podcast to the Rapids, and he was able to immerse himself in the little series that we had on that drive. You've done that drive, Mark, and I can't imagine at some point you need a podcast or something to keep yourself awake, right?
I listened to two whole books on that drive, plus, like, you know, binged a season and a half of podcasts too. So yeah, absolutely. But there's some, you know, you get to roll through Kansas City. You get to roll through some interesting places on your way to Pennsylvania.
So in any case, he said that the podcast provided a nice distraction to the monotonous landscapes of Illinois and Indiana. So I guess some shots being fired at Indy 11 and Chicago Fire, respectively, in terms of their home states. So he said at the end of the draft, you guys picked your favorite Rapids kits, respectively, for the squad that you'd be playing in. And that raised an important question in mind. Where do you rate the current Rapids uniform catalog? Also, what is your favorite alternative Rapids kit in the history? And then also looking at the Colorado flag one, he said that one of his favorites was the blue Colorado flag one. So that would have been the blue and red Rapids kit, Rapids crest with the blue jersey with the yellow trim. And that would have had the, off-white C in the middle of the jersey. That I think is that one, the one at one point, Mark, that had the Chow logo mid-season and then Chow disappeared.
Wow.
As the shirt sponsor.
Could be.
Okay. So in any case, to answer your question, Eric, this is something that we've posed for a while. We've got still like 5 weeks to kill before the actual season starts back. And I feel like this is a really common banter topic, Mark. And I feel like we need to have the definitive answer from the Rapids community. So listeners, I went back last weekend and spent 4 hours scrolling through every single photo that I have ever had from the Colorado Rapids, from Google Images, and from Getty Images to document every single jersey that the Colorado Rapids have worn in a competitive game. And we are doing a full, Mark, a full 31 jersey bracket. I have elected, Mark, the MLS Cup winning Burgundy from 2010 will get a first round bye. So then the other 30 jerseys will play in the preliminary round, the first round proper, FA Cup style. That will leave us 15 jerseys. Then the MLS Cup winning jersey slots in, and then we have a straight 16-1 bracket. We will do all of this through a Twitter poll. I will be releasing everything on our Twitter page, at Rapids96Podcast, in a massive chain on Sunday, and then so the first round will go for next week from Sunday to Saturday, and we'll basically proceed that, Mark. And if we complete that all the way, potentially that final championship Saturday at the end of that final poll in the final will be when the Rapids potentially have their first home game back against New York City FC. So we will have that for you, Eric. There's an opportunity for you to voice your opinion in the entire Twitter thread. I will include the photos of the jerseys that we have, the year that they're from, some basic details, and then the actual poll in the question after that, because unfortunately, Mark, the Twitter machine does not allow you to have any media along with the actual poll tweet that you have. So we are doing this completely randomly. The only stipulation that I put in, I did a random number generator computer model. I wrote code for this, Mark, in order to simulate the first round that we had. And the only thing that I stipulated, the primary colors that the jerseys face off in the first round cannot be the same, and the jerseys can also not play each other if they are from the same season. So the OG 96 jerseys, they can't eliminate each other for this first round. It's random draw after that, and there's no rules, because let's be real, Mark, a lot of white kits are going down in this round.
Well, I was about to say, so that hypothetically means, like, let's say, like, you know, it's paired up a certain way. By the end of the second round, it could just be burgundy kits that survive. I mean, I think it's unlikely because we haven't had that many burgundy kits. The other thing that's cool about this that I didn't think about until right now is that, you know, as an MLS team, there are lots of MLS teams who don't have 30 jerseys worth to knock around. I mean, I think, you know, there are a lot of, almost every team in the league is younger than us. The Rapids are also a rare team in that they went through kind of like two full rebrands too. So like burgundy wasn't the color until 2007. You know, they had black and blue for a while, and they also had green, which were really, black and blue makes sense from the sense of like, you know, water is blue and the Rapids name should be blue. Why the kits were ever green in the beginning, I feel like the Rapids got green because there weren't other green teams at the start of the league, which is a funny other thing that, like, unlike other teams throughout the world, we got, you know, our city got stuck with a certain color because nobody else in the league had that color. Just some funny thoughts I had off the top of my head.
Yeah, so in any case, I have photos for all of them, Mark, and I also dug up a really funny, cool one. I have a backlog. If this goes super successfully and we get, like, you know, 250 or more votes for every single poll, for example, I have it backlogged the entire, all of the goalkeeper jerseys that we have, as well as just a couple of other really funny ones and training tops. Like, there's going to be some fun stuff for me to release after this is all done, of just, like, stuff that I dug up in the process of researching for this. But a couple jerseys that I do want to bring up to your point, Mark, I guess the other thing that I should say, folks, in the, we'll say the MLS 1.0 era, teams often didn't change their jerseys. They changed both of their jerseys every 2 years. So, for example, there's the 96 jerseys, but then there's virtually the exact same. There's a couple minor details that if you really zoom in, you notice difference between the 97 and the 98 jerseys. So I eliminated all of the redundancies in that regard. And then obviously it wasn't until 2013, 2014 when MLS started doing the alternate. You change your primary jersey 1 year and your secondary jersey the next year. I should say footballkit.co.uk had a lot of really good information on this. And then earlier this year, actually, Rapids Republic did a very comprehensive history of Colorado Rapids jerseys. So if you want more details on that or just more information, or you want to look through some of the old jerseys from year to year on the Rapids side, certainly the Rapids Republic article that they had by Joseph Samuelson. And then the other kit website that I plugged, I will put both of those links in the show notes, has kits from all around the world. So if you want to see, like, you know, 40 years of what, like, Liverpool's jersey did, for example, just scroll around and look at those and really put side by side, like, can we really notice the difference between the Burnley Clarendon blue and the Colorado Rapids burgundy and blue? That has a lot of great visuals from that standpoint. But a couple things that I did want to highlight, Mark, you had brought this up in the past. In 2008, the Rapids, as far as I know, for just two games, wore a mostly white shirt with red trim and burgundy shorts that they wore in 2008 in a friendly against Everton Football Club, and then another one against Tigres. That, I guess, technically would have been Tim Howard's first game. He did play in that game with Everton. And then in 2006, Mark, I found I have no record that this shirt was ever worn elsewhere, and it does not resemble the other shirts at all. In a May home game at Old Mile High against DC United, the Rapids wore a green shirt with black shorts, and then it had blue trim. So if you guys remember the all-green kit, for example, that had the black line around it, for example, imagine that, but a little bit thicker and like navy blue. They wore that in one random game. And then I also, for the sake of completeness, Mark, not that I'm expecting them to go very far, I also have the two parlay kits in here as well. So every single jersey that the Rapids have ever worn in an actual competitive game, league game, or sanctioned friendly is included in this. That is the most democratic way. And after that, we will have the absolute definitive, you know, I guess the blue, you know, the Colorado flag kit that lasts the longest and has the highest percentage if the final two go out in the same round, you know, will be, you know, that'll be definitive. We'll have definitively the best burgundy kit and definitively the best Rapids kit of all time, Mark. And I'm really excited to see what ends up happening.
Yeah, just a shout out again to Joe Samuelson at Rapids Republic for doing a really good comprehensive article. I think one of the great things about doing something that is just absolute, you know, a lot of elbow grease, hard work when you write an article is the knowledge that it's going to get, you know, clicks for decades, and it is a service to the people. It is a great asset for soccer fans. I know that there are articles that I wrote for Burgundy Wave that are probably still driving clicks to this day. You know, none of them were any good, but they were thorough.
All right, Mark, let's get out of here. Tell us about this interview that you have for us, and we'll just be doing half of it. So part one of the interview, Mark.
Jordan Angeli is a amazing broadcaster. She's one of the only women on a broadcast team in Major League Soccer, in terms of in the booth as opposed to the on the field reporting. She, of course, is a native of Colorado, played her high school ball, was former Colorado High School Player of the Year, and played at the professional level in the women's league for two different women's leagues in the U.S. Before making the jump to being a broadcaster, plus played on the USWNT U20s and got a sniff at the senior team as well. So she knows soccer really well. She is an absolute wonderful human being. We talk about kind of her journey through soccer, her journey through injury, kind of making that move and what qualities and what it takes to become a broadcaster. and, you know, some of the things that she's learned and picked up along the way with all the people she's worked with. You know, she's just a someone I got to know at Colorado. And I just really thought she was a remarkable individual and really intelligent. Matt, you know that, like, I don't necessarily want to interview every single person we can get our hands on. I mean, I have done, as a reporter, as you have, interviewed almost every player. And sometimes you walk away from an interview and you're like, wow, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do with that. You know, like, that was just seven cliches strung together and a bunch of ums and uhs in between. But from all the times that I talked to Jordan, I thought, this is a fantastic, interesting human being who has lots of interesting things to say. One last plug, which I'll do, you know, again at the end of the series. She's doing a podcast also. She does it with Joe Lowry, who is formerly of American Soccer Analysis, where I write now. And he's writing for The Athletic right now, another outlet that I've written for. Joe is a phenomenal intellect. He knows the math and he knows the tactics and he kind of sees how 11 men move around on the pitch. Jordan is much more incisive about how one or two or three players play off each other, how coaches manage formations, how, individual movements break down. And that podcast, which is called MLS Assist, is fantastic and I highly recommend it. It is easily one of my top five MLS podcasts, for sure. So, when you're done listening to this interview, you may want to check out her work over there.
Listeners, you can follow us individually on Twitter @soccer_rabbi, @LWSMattPollard. Check out our written musings, rapid related, or otherwise at American Soccer Analysis and LastWordOnSoccer.com. Give us a follow on Twitter @Rapids96Podcast. Send us your questions using the #AskHTHL, and we might dedicate a 5-week-long Twitter poll extravaganza to it. If you've got something longer form, like Eric Hoffman, send us an email @Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com, Patreon.com/Rapids96Podcast, and DenverPost.com/HTHL if we bring monetary value to your lives and you are in a position where you are able to and want to give us money. Obviously, there's a number of other things that are more critical for you at this time. And then, of course, if you are looking for custom, individualized, very detailed, and not cookie-cutter jerseys, check out IcarusFC.com. And if you need a Rapids customized mask or scarf, head on over to RoughneckScarves.com. Without further ado, here is part one of Mark's conversation with Jordan and Jelly.
Welcome, everybody. This is Holding the High Line with Rabbi and Red. We have a special guest this afternoon, evening, morning. Time is a flat circle. Nothing is no time is relevant anymore now that we're in the coronavirus quarantine. But we're really glad to have Jordan Angeli, former Rapids broadcaster, former professional soccer player, all around great gal, wonderful person. Jordan, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
We are great. We are really enjoying this. We were talking before we started. To have family around, and
yeah,
have family around all the time. I have a 9-year-old and a 7-year-old who need to get from one Zoom call to the other and don't know the passcode. So
yeah, you're the passcode holder. You just try to figure it out for them. And they're not just on any Zoom calls. They're on karate and chess Zoom calls, which I know nothing about either thing. So the fact that they do that, props to them.
Yeah, I mean, the flip side of that is a lot of really great soccer content providers and former players are doing things like, you know, skills challenges and
yeah,
stuff. And so I see all this stuff about, like, you know, juggling or like doing this, you know, working on a back heel this or a Cruyff turn that. And I turn to my son and I'll say, hey, do you want to do this? And he'll be like, no, not at all. He'd rather do chess online. So my future of being a parent of a professional soccer player is not looking great, but, you know, he might be the next Garry Kasparov. Who knows? The next big, big chess guy. How have you been riding out the coronavirus? Where are you? What are you doing? What does your day look like?
Yeah, I have been riding it out with my family. So I actually came back from, I had just moved to Columbus to take a job with the Columbus Crew. And I came back right when that initial delay in MLS happened because I just wanted to shore up some things. I thought it would really just be like a 30-day delay and I could get back in time to be where I needed to be. And so now I've been here for almost, I think I've been here actually now over 7 weeks, and it's been great, honestly, to be with my family. I was just feeling really grateful of all the things that we have as people that live in America. And, you know, even the family that I have, to get along with them. We've had a really good 7 weeks of, playing Mexican Train or playing Five Crowns, I think is another game we've been playing. But my brother and I also got, we dabbled in TikTok. So we did some TikTok videos. And we also have been creating some, our newest thing is we found some designs, like wood designs that you can make on like a big piece of art. And so we've been making these wood designs, which has been really fun. Like, I'm a person who craves creativity, and I've actually been pretty busy with the amount of work that I've had throughout this time. So the days where I can just like break away and do something creative, I've really been soaking that up. So honestly, I feel like it could be a lot worse. And I know that I'm just grateful personally for health of my family and to people around me. And, you know, hopefully a lot of people can say that same thing when we get out of this, and hopefully it's, the impact isn't as bad as it could have been, because we've done what we could do.
So of the things that everybody in the universe seems to be doing while they're stuck on quarantine, it sounds like you've done an art project. Have you done, have you guys done puzzles?
No, we're not puzzlers.
No puzzles. Okay. Nope. Sourdough starter?
No sourdough. I'm gluten-free, so I do not. I have made plenty of banana bread, gluten-free banana bread. Does that count?
So baking.
Baking. Baking. Check.
Any other cooking? Any like new recipes that you've taught yourself or learned or participated in?
Yeah, my brother and I made some enchiladas the other day, and I made the enchilada sauce. We did not get the canned enchilada sauce, which I felt like was a big win.
That's good. I'm in the same ballpark. We taught ourselves how to make tortillas. So,
oh, were they good?
It's easier than you think, and totally better than store-bought. So highly recommended.
Yeah. My teammate in college, Michaela Esquivel, is from New Mexico, and she used to make homemade tortillas and homemade green chili. And that was like,
did you get her recipe for enchilada sauce?
No, because we did a red sauce, but I should have, because I like green chili better than red enchilada sauce anyway. So next time I'm doing that. Good suggestion.
You're a good Coloradan, so you know that the state question of New Mexico is red or green. So
yeah, green for sure.
Little known fact, I lived in New Mexico before I moved to California, before I moved to Colorado. But we're not here to hear my story. We're here to hear yours. And that's a great transition. So I don't know what the average fan knows of you from our MLS listeners. They may have been like, oh yeah, she's that woman who used to call games for the Rapids. But, you know, you have a remarkable backstory as an exceptional soccer player in your own right. You were the Colorado High School Player of the Year?
Yeah. Honestly, I forget about that sometimes. It feels like a long time ago.
What year was that, and what high school?
2004, Green Mountain High School. Go Rams.
And then you were recruited to play Division I college soccer. Did you have a bunch of different schools chasing you? And you ended up choosing Santa Clara, but what were the other choices in the mix?
Yeah, I fortunately did. I went to a camp at Santa Clara in 2001, and I went on the campus and I knew like this was the team for me. Like, I wanted to go there. It was set in my mind. And 2001, they ended up in that fall. So I went there in the summer. In the fall, they ended up winning a national championship. So I was like, whoa, the ante has been upped. Now you want to go to a national championship organization. And so that was kind of my lofty goal, but I kept it out there and I kept trying to strive for that. But yeah, I had a lot of a handful of teams. Purdue was maybe the first one that really pursued me pretty hard, but it came down to Florida State, Stanford, Santa Clara, Pepperdine. I took all my official visits and went to all those places, and Santa Clara just felt like the right one. And when they gave me a shot, I figured this was something I had to take hold of and go for.
And how did they do in your 4 years of playing with them?
We did all right. I was there for six because I had two ACLs in a year. So I took a red shirt and a medical red shirt. So in my 6 years, we really had some ups and downs. My first year was incredible. We went to the Final Four and unfortunately lost in the semifinal, but we were a really good squad. My junior year, I would say we were probably the best team as far as our composition of who we were and the skill sets that we had on that squad. But it was probably the most devastating year because it was the first time ever we lost in the first round, which that had never happened to Santa Clara history. So that was really difficult. But ups and downs, I think in the end, we ended up getting to the Sweet 16, which was great, but we lost to Stanford. It was playing in the Bay Area is hard, especially women's soccer. You've got Cal, Stanford, Santa Clara. So if you make the playoffs and they do regionalization, you're playing those teams right away. And it's just like, you're not getting like University of Florida gets like Southwestern Florida State, you know. It just is unfortunate.
The Pitt men this last year played a college in on the other side of the state that I'd never heard of, and so I was thrilled to see that they, you know, that's exactly what you say.
Right.
The next round they got Clemson, so you know,
exactly.
It all evens out in the end. So you mentioned your ACL tear. Was your college year, freshman year or sophomore year, your first ACL tear ever? Did you have one in high school?
No, I never got injured before I tore my ACL the first time. Like little things, but never broke a bone, never sprained an ankle. I had a hamstring strain once, I remember. I had a quad strain once, I remember. But besides that, I played all the time. And so that first ACL coming off the under 20 Women's World Cup year and that really challenging emotional year that I was saying, that was my junior year where we lost at the World Cup and then we lost in the first round. And I ended up tearing it that spring of my junior year. It was really hard because soccer is who you are, you think, and it's your identity. And that was a big challenge for me to try to figure out who I was beyond that as well.
How did it happen?
The first one happened. It was late in a training session. It was a Thursday training session. I remember it vividly. I felt really weird that day. And it was actually the day that I found out from my college counselor that I was going to be graduating on time. And I didn't think that was going to be possible because the year before I had taken a quarter off to go play on the under 20s with the under 20s for a World Cup. And so I had taken some extra classes. And that morning, my counselor was like, you can graduate on time if you do this, this, and this. And I was like pretty excited about it. Right. I got to be there with my classmates as we graduated. And so I went into training that day and I felt weird. Like, I think it was this high and low emotional roller coaster. And 5 minutes left in training, I was defending, and Chama Igwe was dribbling at me, and she did a step over to go to her left, and I pushed off my left to go to my right. And when I did that, I think I was tired. I had a hamstring issue that was kind of nagging me for a while, but I didn't do anything about it because I could play, and I wanted to play. And as I pushed with my left, I looked down, and my knee was somewhere you shouldn't see your knee, and I felt it, and I knew, I mean, everybody always says it when you tear your ACL, you know it. You don't really, but like, you're like, that is not what it should feel like. And so, it was hard in a lot of different ways, but, it was also in the end, you know, sitting here today, I know that those injuries really blessed me to do what I was able to do.
Yeah. I'm going to fast forward on that a little bit because you had a number of injuries, later on.
Mm-hmm.
You've become something of an advocate in the ACL injury world for players. You've been fairly outspoken about kind of both the physical recovery, but also the emotional kind of connection or frustration or difficulty of it. Can you talk a little bit about how you got involved in working with other athletes who've experienced ACL tears?
I got involved with it, Mark, because everybody would ask me, you know, I had gone through it and I had been in the Colorado area, a player that people just kind of knew, you know, through Colorado Rush and the success that my team had there. And just the club scene here. So if there was a coach that knew me who they had a player who had gone through an ACL injury, they would text me and say, hey, Jordan, can you talk to this person? What I started noticing is it wasn't just me feeling this way. It wasn't just me feeling like I felt like all I was a soccer player. And then now I don't have that. And going through this grieving process and feeling like I was scared and fearful, and that all those things and those sticky points were happening in a particular way for everybody, but everything was pretty common as well. And the things that I was talking to people about were all the same things. And I was like, man, there is clearly a need and I need to fill it. And so it was really on that mental and emotional side. So I created the ACL Club about 6 years ago. And it was just to do that, to tell people you're heard, you're understood, you're supported. And I want to empower you to say, this is my journey and I'm going to choose to make it the best I can make it, which is, I can get better through this. I can get back through this, and all those empowerment kind of motivation. So it's been really rewarding. It's been really challenging, but I just don't want anybody to ever go through what I went through, feeling like maybe they don't have a voice in their recovery, in choosing the doctor that they want to have and choosing the PT that they want to have and choosing the timeline, right, to give themselves time to heal both physically and emotionally. So just really giving them a space where they feel like they can heal fully.
It's interesting. I'm just going to make a kind of a strange allusion, but it's interesting to me how maybe the ACL injury for players and the coronavirus have a small amount in common, to the degree that there are lots of players all over the country who have been saying to themselves, this is my year. I am so ready, right? Like, I'm thinking of a guy like Andre Shinyashiki for the Rapids, who had a banger of a first year and was ready to, like, come in and just tear this league up. And then, much like a guy who goes through an ACL tear, except it's the whole league, it's all put on hold. And there's this sense of, you know, athletic recovery or staying fit is the thing that's going to keep their season on track.
There's been so many parallels, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's something I've been talking to the ACL Club about. I was like, you've been prepared for this moment. And one of the things that you learn when you're going through something traumatic is that it really reveals your character, right? Trauma reveals character. And I am telling people that you have a choice of who you're going to be in this time, right? We've had 7 weeks where life has really looked so much different than it has in a long time. What are we choosing to do? Well, how are we choosing to engage with other people? How are we choosing to get better at something, you know, whatever it is during this quarantine, during this coronavirus? It's the same thing for people going through ACLs. Like, yeah, you might not feel like this should have happened to you. We're all here thinking this shouldn't have happened to us, right? But we can't change it. So what are we going to do to get the best, make the best result out of what we're doing? And that's kind of what I always tell people is, like, in the end, it's your choice. And you have the power to choose something really great for it to become.
Did you, in your time, either in Colorado or in the NWSL or the WSL, get to spend, or the W League, sorry, get to have those kinds of conversations with players, and either as a mentee, you know, turning to an older player and saying, wow, I just injured myself, what's the way back? Or in the other end of being a mentor and saying to someone, like, I've been where you are and it gets better and it's not always going to be this hard.
Yeah, both. I think one of the things I've really found, and one of the reasons I wanted to create the ACL Club, is because when I saw somebody's scar, it felt like I knew them. I knew a little bit about their journey, even though I could know nothing about them, right? It's that connector point. And so during when I played WPS and I was playing with Kelly Smith, who is an all-time great English international, probably the best player England has ever produced. And she had multiple injuries through her career. And I got to watch her firsthand how she maintained her body throughout an entire season, and how she chose herself. And by choosing herself and maybe choosing rest some days, it actually benefited the team. So that was a really good thing for me to see, because I would then use that when I was playing in NWSL. And then, yeah, on the other end, as a mentee or mentoring other people, just the connection point to go up to a player like this year with Columbus. Milton Valenzuela is a left outside back for the Crew, stud of a player, just coming back from an ACL that he suffered last season during preseason. And I was asking him how he was feeling and what that first game was like. And the way he smiled at me when he said, when he got to play his first 90 minutes, I felt it because I know what that feels like. And I shared a little bit of that with him. And I don't know him very well, but I feel like that connector point was really something special and a unique thing that I can share with people who've gone through it or are going through it.
And I think it's really valuable to be able to look at as a broadcaster, but also just as a human being, to look at a player who's gone through an ACL tear. I think a lot of your standard commentators or your kind of blowhard, you know, pundits will look at a player who's been injured and say, well, I don't know if I'd pick him up in my, you know, if they were free agent because they're a risk and yada, yada, yada. And to instead of address them as an injury or as a injury prone player, to address them as that person who came back, and that resiliency is a human skill that you want in your players. You know, all players will go through ups and downs, and you want the player who will go through the downs and come back up, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. I like that point. And I also think empathy is something that is, we all need some more empathy in our lives, right? And to be able to have that connection with other people. And I think I have that, and it can be challenging sometimes on the other side of things as a broadcaster to feel empathetic for somebody because of what they've gone through. But at the end of the day, like, I have to say what I'm seeing, and I have to be real. Otherwise the people on the other end don't believe, you know, don't trust me, and they can't build that relationship with me. So yeah, it's interesting. It's been an interesting kind of give and take.
I remember when I asked, we came out to training, and I had to ask Anthony Hudson when we were, I think we had lost six games in a row in his second to last season, i.e. His first season. And I preface it by saying, I don't really want to ask these questions. And he was super nice about it. He was like, I know you don't. I understand. It's not personal, you know?
Yeah.
I get it. I'm with you that, like, you know, when you see no matter how much you like a player, a bad performance on the field is a bad performance on the field.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we had that with Dylan Cerna, where a number of us in the writers' corps wrote about Cerna having a breakout performance at left back. Because he had a game that he was really good, and then he had another game when he was really good, and then he had a game where he was bad, and then he had another game where he was really bad. And it was really hard, because I don't think too many Coloradans who weren't in their guts rooting for Dylan.
Rooting for him, yeah, for sure. It's a hard part of the job.
Back to being a player. So where you get to control your destiny. So you have a standout career at Santa Clara. Did you play exclusively at striker? Did you play some defender?
Oh gosh.
Everything?
No, I everything. Option D was the right ABCD, everything. I started as an outside back my freshman year, ended as a man marker. So I got to man mark my first assignment man marking. Was Christine Sinclair at the University of Portland.
Wow.
And the all-time leading international goal scorer currently. And she's still, like, we're friends now, and she will just, like, still talk to me about how much she hated that game because I was, like, on her so tight. She did not get the ball without, like, me breathing down her neck.
Wow.
And, she didn't score a goal. We ended up winning. So then I was the man marker for the rest of the year, which led us to a, one of the small pieces that led us to a Final Four. But so my freshman year, I played those two spots. And then my second 2 years, I played in up top in a front three. So typically a number nine, but we really were interchanging up front, the front three. So I kind of was everywhere. And then before I got injured, I started playing as a holding midfielder. And then when I came back from my injuries, I was a center back. So Jerry was like, you got to be on the field.
Have you ever played goalkeeper? Because it sounds like you've done everything else.
We don't talk about those days when I played goalkeeper because they were brutal.
So you graduate from Santa Clara, you finish up your college career, and you turn pro and you get drafted.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that you are an exceptional soccer player, and I'm sure people were telling you at the time that you're an exceptional soccer player, but there's still the kind of leap of faith, one, to say, I'm going to make myself available for the draft and let everybody know that I'm good enough to play professionally, one. And two, you know, you came out as a professional in, what, 2010?
Yeah, that was my first year, yeah.
I mean, you know, to be real blunt, there ain't a lot of money in women's soccer now, and there certainly wasn't a lot of money in women's soccer in 2010. What was that decision like for you, and did you feel like, were you all in for it? Was it obvious for you, or was it a decision?
Oh, I was all in. Like, I always wanted to be a professional soccer player since I remember being 13 at regionals in California and watching the women play for the 99 World Cup. And I knew, like, that's what I wanted to be. I remember in my brain and my heart, like, just keying into that moment and saying, that's going to be me someday. So that was, you know, even through the trials of the two ACLs back to back, when WPS came, it was my right after my fifth year. So if I would have graduated on time, I actually would have had a year where I wouldn't have had anything, you know, no team to play for in the US. And then after my sixth year, the WPS had already been playing a year. And so it was kind of a little bit established. And I was coming off a pretty good season. I had come back from my two ACLs. But what I didn't tell anybody when I signed up for the draft is I had retorn my meniscus and I had surgery at the beginning of December. And none of the coaches that I had chatted with, including my coach, Tony DiCicco, who ended up drafting me, had any idea that that had happened, because I didn't want to be deceitful, but I just didn't want them to think that it was going to change who I was as a player. So I had that little scope and got my meniscus removed and then got drafted, which was all in itself like an incredible moment. Not many people get to say that they got to experience that, and I got to go to the draft with my parents and stand up on the stage with a Boston Breakers scarf. It was just a really cool thing that feels surreal now talking about it. Mind you, it's not like NFL draft. It was a small room in a conference, a huge conference center, a small room that maybe had 60 people in it, but to me it felt like it was the biggest room in the world, because my dream had just come true. And so I always knew, like, money didn't really, I didn't even like cross my mind about the money. And actually in WPS, the minimum at that time was a lot greater than the minimum was in NWSL for years. The min was $20,000. And so, you know, $20,000 didn't seem, yeah, it's not great, I'm not going to lie, but if you're looking at NWSL, the minimum for a few years was like 7,000. And so it was structurally, it was just wasn't really set up for success in the long term, was WPS, but it was really cool. I got to play against, you know, I was telling you my teammate was Kelly Smith. I got to play against Caroline Seger, who's a Swedish international, really, really good player. Sonia Bonpastor was in the league, the French international. Who else was there? Oh, Marta played for every team she went to, ended up folding, and that's really why the league folded. But that's another story. But I got to play against Marta, and it's just that league. If you could take the players that played in that league and put them in NWSL with the security of this league, hands down the best league in the world, because the players that were playing in that league were so good.
Yeah, the W League started to look shaky to me when one of the teams renamed itself Magic Jack. And I said, that's not a thing that you should do as a team. That's not. Then again, MLS has a team named after a energy drink. So
right. Who
am I to criticize?
Right.
you moved to Boston. You also then go on to Washington, and then eventually the W League folds, and then those players and some of those teams even, I think, were reallocated to the NWSL. What was that? This is a little bit of like women's league history, which I was basically not aware of, and I don't know that anybody's really spent any time thinking about it. But what was the transition like as a player when did you wake up one day and get a memo or an email or something like that that said like, yeah, our team and our league don't exist anymore. You're all free agents. Good luck. Like what was the end and what was the transition? Yeah. What was the beginning of the next part of the journey?
So in WPS, we knew that fourth year was going to be really important because the WUSA, which was the first women's professional league, folded after 3 years. And so if WPS could make it past that third year, we really thought, okay, maybe it will survive. And it didn't end up happening. So I honestly don't remember how it all went down because I was pretty focused in my own right. I had at the start, so my first year playing pro, I was WPS best 11. I was runner up rookie of the year. I was the leading rookie goal scorer. Like I was surrounded by the most incredible team and we went really far. We ended up losing in the semifinal, but that group that I was around propelled me to be better, which is exactly what you want in a professional environment, right? And so I was with the national team the following year and really feeling great. And the last year of WPS, so my second year, first game, I re-tore my ACL for the third time. So honestly, that last season of WPS was really different for me. I was home about half the time. I got surgery here in Colorado at Stedman Hawkins Clinic in the Denver Tech Center. And then I had to get a double surgery. So I had to get everything taken out of my knee and my bones grafted. And then I had to wait 5.5 months to get my ACL put in. And so, yeah, I don't remember what happened because the league folded in the fall winter time. And I was like full on in, I just am recovering from ACL injury again. And at that point, after I tore my ACL for the third time, I really just didn't know. I didn't know if I could do it. Like that was the first time I really doubted myself in thinking like, Jordan, what'd you say?
Was it the same knee every time?
Yeah. Same knee, 3 times on my left knee. Wow. So I just didn't know if it was in the cards to play soccer again. So I had changed my whole mindset going into rehab saying, okay, Jordan, like you need to be happy again. You need to be healthy again. And that was my only goal. And it wasn't until NWSL formed and you talked about that reallocation of players. So there was a whole year without professional women's soccer in the US. And then that following year in 2013, NWSL started and they had taken names from, I don't know, old coaches, people, and basically made this draft of players who had played in WPS that could potentially be playing in NWSL. And I still don't know to this day who put my name in that draft. But one day in February, I started getting all these texts from people like, oh my gosh, congratulations. Are you playing like this and that? And I'm like, what is going on? And then I get a call from this guy named Michael Jordan and unfortunately, it wasn't the Michael Jordan that we're all watching so closely right now with The Last Dance. It was my new coach at the Washington Spirit, Michael Jordan, which was cool in its own right. I was like, you just drafted me? Like, you have no idea. I hadn't played soccer. I was just getting back to like feeling all right again. But that really inspired me and said, okay, clearly somebody believes in me enough to put me in this draft. And then somebody's crazy enough to draft me. So, I decided I was going to try and it took me that whole year to get back into soccer shape. And I went out to the Spirit the following preseason and they said, all right, you're here on a trial basis. And if you can win a roster spot, you can win a roster spot. And somehow in God's good grace, I did. So